If Sean could be so constant and self-sacrificing in his love for another man, then she hoped that she could expect the same constancy from him in their own different but even more intense relationship. Job groaned again and began to thrash about restlessly. She sighed and then gently disentangled herself from Sean's sleeping form, stood up and crossed to where Job lay. A cloud of metallic green flies buzzed around the blood-soaked bandage that covered his shoulder. They settled on the soiled dressing and tasted it with their long proboscises, then rubbed their front legs together with delight. Claudia saw that they had lain their rice-grain eggs in thick rafts in the bloody cloth, and with an exclamation of disgust she fanned them away and then scraped the loathsome white eggs from the folds of the bandage. Job opened his eyes and looked up at her. She realized that he was fully conscious once again, and she smiled encouragingly at him. "Would you like another drink?" "No." His voice was so low that she had to lean closer to him. "You have to make him do it," he said.
"Who? Sean?" she asked,
and Job nodded. "He can't go on like this. He's killing himself. Without him, none of you will survive. You must make him leave me here." She had begun to shake her head before he stopped speaking. "No," she said firmly, "he would never do it. And I wouldn't let him, even if he wanted to. We are in this together, partner." She touched his arm. "Now, how about that drink?" He subsided, too weak to argue further. Like Sean, Job also seemed to have deteriorated alarmingly in the last few hours. She sat beside him, fanning the flies away with an Ilala palm frond, while the sun slid slowly down the western sky. In the cool of the afternoon, Sean stirred and sat up, instantly wide awake, taking in his surroundings with a quick glance. Sleep revived and fortified him. "How is he?" he asked. And when she shook her head, he came to squat beside her. "We'll have to get him up again pretty soon."
"Give him a few more minutes," she pleaded, and then went on. "Do you know what I've been thinking about while I've been sitting here?"
"Tell me," he invited, and put his arm around her shoulders.
"I've been thinking about that water hole out there. I've been fantasizing about pouring water over myself, washing my clothes, getting rid of this stink."
"Have you heard about Napoleon?" he asked.
"Napoleon?" she looked puzzled. "What does he have to do with bathing?"
"Whenever he returned from a campaign, he would send a galloper ahead of him to Josephine with a message. 'Je rentre. Ne te lave pas. I'm coming home. Don't bathe.' You see, he liked his ladies the way he liked his cheese. Full-bodied. He would have loved you the way you are now."
"How disgusting!"
She punched his shoulder, and Job groaned. "Hey there," Sean turned his attention to him. "What's going down, man?"
"I'll take you up on your offer now," Job whispered.
"Morphine?" Sean asked, and Job nodded. "Just a little shot, okay?" "You've got it," Sean agreed, and reached for the medical pack. After the injection, Job lay with his eyes closed, and they watched the taut lines of pain around his mouth slowly relax. "Better?" Sean asked, and Job smiled softly without opening his eyes. "We'll give you a few minutes more," Sean told him, "while we make the radio shed with banana tree." Sean stood up and went across to where Alfonso was already rigging the radio aerial.
"Ungalube, this is banana tree."
The response to Alfonso's first call was so strong and clear that Sean started. Alfonso adjusted the gain and then thumbed the microphone and gave another fictitious position report, as though he were still on the return march to the river area. There was a pause, filled only by the drone and crackle of static, and then another voice, equally clear and loud.
"Let me speak to Colonel Courtney."
The intonation was unmistakable, and Alfonso looked up at Sean. General China, he whispered. And he offered Sean the microphone, but Sean pushed it aside and frowned with concentration as he waited for the next transmission. In the silence that followed, Claudia left Job's side and crossed quickly to Sean. She squatted beside him, and he placed his arm around her protectively. They both stared at the radio.
The deserters, she said softly.
China knows.
Listen,
Sean cautioned. They waited.
Very well,
China's voice again.
I can understand that you do not wish to reply. However, I will presume that you are listening, Colonel.
All their attention was on the radio, and Job opened his eyes. He'd heard every word that China spoke quite clearly, and rolled his head. Alfonso had left his pack and webbing piled on his blanket, not 10 paces from where Job lay. The butt of the Tokarev pistol protruded from the side pocket of the pack.
You have yet to disappoint me, Colonel.
China's voice was mellow and affable.
It would have been too simple and totally unsatisfying if you had merely blundered into the arms of the reception committee I'd arranged for you at the Zimbabwean border.
Job eased himself up on his good elbow. There was no pain, merely a sensation of weakness and drowsiness. The morphine was working. It was difficult to think clearly. He focused all his attention on the pistol, and he wondered if Alfonso had chambered around. He began to move towards it, extending his legs, digging in his heels, then lifting his buttocks clear and jackknifing his legs. He made no sound, and the others were all concentrating on the voice from the radio.
So the game is still on, Colonel, or should we rather call it the hunt? You are a great hunter, a great white hunter. You glory in the pursuit of wild animals. You call it sport, and you pride yourself on what you term fair chase.
Job was halfway across the clearing. There was still no pain, and he moved a little quicker. At any moment, one of them might turn their head and see him.
I have never understood your white man's passion for this pursuit. To me, it always seems so pointless. My people have always believed that if you want meat, you should kill it as efficiently and with as little effort as possible.
Job reached the pile of equipment on Alfonso's blanket and stretched out to touch the hilt of the pistol. However, when he tried to withdraw it from the pocket, his fingertips were numb and it slipped from his hand. But instead of clattering on the hard earth, the pistol dropped soundlessly onto a fold of the blanket, and he saw with a rush of relief that the action was cocked and the safety catch engaged. Alfonso had loaded it, ready for instant use. Behind him, China's voice still echoed from the radio set.
Perhaps you have corrupted me, Colonel. Perhaps I am acquiring your decadent European ways. But for the last time, I understand your passion. Perhaps it is simply that at last the game is big enough to excite me. I wonder how you must feel at this change of role, Colonel. You are the game, and I am the hunter. I know where you are, but you don't know where I am. Perhaps I am closer than you believed possible. Where am I, Colonel? You must guess. You must run and hide. When will we meet, and how?
Job settled his fingers carefully around the butt of the Tokarev. He lifted it and was surprised by the effort it required. He placed his thumb upon the slide of the safety catch, and it would not budge. He felt panic rising in him. His hand was too weak and numb to move the slide forward into the firing position.
I do not promise you fair chase, Colonel. I will hunt you in my own African way, but it will be good sport. I promise you that at least.
Job exerted all his strength and felt the slide of the safety catch begin to move under his thumb.
The time is now 1800 hours Zulu. I will call you on this frequency at the same time tomorrow, Colonel. That is,
if we have not already met. Until then, watch the sky, Colonel Courtney. Look behind you. You do not know from which direction I will come. But be sure, I will come.
There was a faint click as China unkeyed his microphone, and Sean reached over and switched off the radio set to conserve the battery. None of them spoke or moved until another, sharper, metallic click broke the silence. To Sean, the sound was unmistakable, the sound of a safety catch being disengaged, and he reacted instinctively, pushing Claudia flat and whirling round to face it. For a moment he was paralysed, and then he screamed,
"No, Joe, for Christ's sake, no!"
and hurled himself forward like a sprinter from the blocks. Job was lying on his side, facing Sean, but well beyond his reach. Sean drove himself across the space that separated them, but he seemed to be wading through honey, sticky and slow. It impeded his movements. He watched Job raise the pistol, and he tried to prevent him by the force of his gaze. They were looking into each other's eyes, Sean trying to dominate and command him. But Job's eyes were sad, filled with a deep regret, and yet unwavering. Sean saw him open his lips and heard the muzzle of the pistol click against his teeth as Job thrust it deeply into his own mouth and closed his lips around the muzzle, like a child sucking a frozen lollipop. Sean reached out desperately, straining with all his strength to reach Job's pistol hand and rip the stubby black barrel out of his mouth. His fingertips had only touched Job's wrist when the pistol fired. The sound was muffled, dampened down by the flesh and bone of Job's skull. In his extremity of effort, Sean's vision was enhanced to unnatural clarity, and it seemed that time had been suspended so that everything happened very slowly, like a movie reel run at half speed. Job's head altered shape. It swelled before Sean's eyes like a rubber Halloween mask filled with a high-pressure gas. His eyelids flew wide open, and for an instant his eyeballs bulged from their sockets, exposing a wide rim of white around their dark iris, and then rolling upwards into his skull. His shattered head changed shape again, elongating backwards, stretching his skin tightly over his cheekbones and flattening his nostrils as the bullet drew the contents of his skull out through the back of his head, whiplashing his neck to its full stretch, so that even in the aftermath of the shot, Sean heard the vertebrae creak and click. Job was jerked backwards, his arm flung away from his head in a debonair salute, with a Tokarev pistol still gripped in his clenched fist. But Sean was quick enough to catch him before his mutilated head hit the hard earth. He caught Job in his arms and held him to his chest with all his strength. His body was heavy and hot with fever, but slack and plastic, as though it contained no bone. It seemed to overflow Sean's enfolding arms, and he held him hard. He felt Job's muscles shiver and shudder, and his legs kicked in a macabre little jigging movement, and he tried to hold him still. "Job," he whispered, and reached up behind him and cupped his hand over the back of his head, covering the terrible exit wound, as though he were trying to hold it together to press the spilled contents back into the ruptured skull. "You fool," he whispered. "You shouldn't have done it." He laid his own cheek against Job's and held him like a lover. "We would have made it. I would have got you out." Still hugging Job's quiescent body, he began to rock him gently, murmuring to him softly, pressing his cheek to Job's, his eyes closed tightly. "We've come so far together. It wasn't fair to end it here." Claudia came to them and went down on one knee beside Sean. She reached out to touch his shoulder and searched desperately for something to say, but there were no words, and she stopped her hand before she touched him. Sean was oblivious of her and everything else around him. His grief was so terrible to see
that she felt she shouldn't watch it. It was too private, too vulnerable. And yet she could not tear her eyes from his face.